this is Alan Chartok. Joining us today is Jay Levy, the Western and Central Massachusetts Regional Manager with Elliott Community Human Services. Levy is a social worker and the author of the new book, Homeless Narratives and Pre-Treatment Pathways, From Words to Housing, which is published by Loving Healing Press. Jay Levy, thank you for being here.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Okay. We hear about the homeless, we hear about the homeless, and many people manage to compartmentalize it and ignore it. And that's, I think, one of our problems, because there is still in the American psyche this business about, you know, if they knew what they were doing, they wouldn't be homeless. Is it their fault?
Well, I think, no, it isn't. I think it's interesting because I think you're right. That's a popular myth that the people that are out there are just choosing to be out there. And the whole kind of premise of my book is to talk about the stories, what people have been through, how they adapt and transition to homelessness, and what happens to the psyche over time, and how a person's story unfolds living out on the streets or in the shelters. And it becomes a quest of survival and meaning making. And I think, you know, as people, we make meaning in the world, and so do folks that are homeless. And the issue is getting to understand that person's world and to bridge them over. And this is the great challenge of homeless outreach. How do we bridge them over to the world of human services, to the world of housing? Because a lot of the folks that I've worked with over the years, the long-term homeless, are folks, like I said, who are really out there, very much adapted to the streets and the lives that they're living. And for them to ask for help is very hard, because what they need to do is to hear that there's really an offer that can resonate in their world, that makes sense to them, and one that's not really challenging the meaning that they've made and the adaptations that they've made over the years just to survive in the streets. One of the values people hang on to is a value of safety, a value of freedom. And when we make an offer to a program maybe that's very structured, or we say you need to get clean first, you need to address issues of addiction or mental health, all of those words, the way they reverberate in the world of the homeless person is very, very different, and sometimes even insulting to the person, because they don't necessarily have insight into those very issues that we're asking them to address that they need to do in order to move forward and to get involved in programs that may help.
So who's the we, you say, when we ask them?
Well, I'm talking about the outreach workers, you know, across America that go out and try to meet people, hopefully, where they're at. In my book, I talk about a whole pre-treatment approach, which means connecting with people on a level of relationship building, understanding stages of engagement, being able to consider safety issues, basic issues like when crisis intervention is needed because someone might be unstable and either a danger to themselves or others, or on a level of harm reduction, meaning maybe somebody needs a blanket to stay warm overnight, and at the same time we're using that blanket as a need item to help engage someone and build the trust that's necessary, at the same time letting people know that we respect their autonomy. And then the other challenges around helping people to transition and adapt, and it's a lot of common language building. So it's understanding people's words, ideas, and values, and appealing to that and bridging those notions over to the programs and the helpers that are out there.
So, Jay Levy, how did you come to this?
Oh, boy. Well, I started out in Brooklyn as a young man, and I was going to social work school, kind of wondering who I would work with. And on my doorstep was people who were homeless. You know, every day taking the subway out to Columbia University, where I went to school, I would come across people on the subway or in the stations. And on my way back, heading home, I would also come across people who were homeless. So it was right in front of my nose. If I go back to an earlier time in my life before that, you know, I had some friends that had struggled with mental health issues. And even in college, I remember people dropping out of college who were having their first mental health breaks. And so, you know, I've always had this connection to people who struggled and wanted to reach out and help in some way. And it was really great to see something that was happening, you know, right in front of me that I could do something about. So I took advantage of that.
Jay Levy, let me ask you this. You know, I was born and bred in Manhattan. I would walk down the street with my father. There would be some guy sitting there. I'm an old guy now. So we're talking, this is a long-term problem. I'm almost 70 years old. I'm 69 years old. And somebody would say, can you give me some money? Can you spare some change? Isn't there an industry of beggars who claim that they're homeless who aren't?
There is. I mean, there's first of all, there's a lot of poverty in America, and there's a lot of people who struggle to make ends meet, and some of them may not be homeless, and they're out there begging. In fact, out in Northampton in western Massachusetts, where I do a lot of my work, there were some issues with the different businesses, and they were very concerned with all the people asking for money and what it did to the patrons and whether people felt threatened. And that's, you know, understandable. People need to do their business. And what happened was we met with all of the businesses in the area and we said, what is going on? And we brought the outreach workers into the room. And once we figured out who was actually asking for money, over 80% of the people that were asking for the money were in fact not homeless. Now, that's not
amazing.
To say.
Yeah. And some of them were saying they were homeless.
Well, they weren't necessarily saying they were homeless, but people were presuming they were homeless. And it was hard to know what the people that are, you know, carrying signs that says, you know, I'm a homeless veteran or whatever the sign might say. I mean, it's hard to check on everyone's story.
Sure.
But most of the people we actually knew were living in, now, it was people living in low-income housing and struggling to make ends meet, but they weren't necessarily homeless. So I think this idea, and it's one of maybe the myths that goes on, is that most of the people, you know, outside that are begging and asking for money are part of the homeless population, not necessarily.
So is there any move to certify homeless people to say, okay, we'll give you credentials that say you're homeless?
No, I haven't heard of anything like that. There's some government accounting as to what they consider homelessness to be. And, you know, you could have arguments over what makes someone homeless. Is someone couch surfing or maybe doesn't have a home of their own, but
Sure. They're
sharing with a friend? Is that a homeless person?
Is it?
Well, according to HUD, you know, coming down from the federal level, it's not. But, you know, according to advocates, they would say, yes, these are the folks among the homeless. So you get these very different numbers is how many people are homeless in America. You know, when you do the official HUD count, we have found in past years, last couple of years, that over 640,000 people are homeless across America. Now, this is on a given day of
Sure.
the count. If you were to look at all the people coming in and out of homelessness over an entire year, we're looking at somewhere around 2.5 to 3.5 million people. Because 80% of the people who are homeless, they're coming in and out of homeless, are short-term homeless individuals. Now, what my book is about is really talking about the people who are long-term homeless. And the reason I focus on that is because there's been federal initiatives, and also this has been my life's work, which has been to work with this population. But the current federal initiatives for a long time has been to really, well, the last few years anyways, has been to focus on long-term homeless, what they call chronically homeless individuals.
Who are they?
Well, the chronically homeless, first of all, are the folks who have been homeless at least 12 consecutive months or have had 4 episodes of homelessness within a 3-year period. And among them are all sorts of people. I mean, you have veterans, you have people, you have to have a disability to be considered chronically homeless as well. So we're looking at people with mental health issues, with head injury issues, people who are coming out of their veterans. They might have, you know, had a head injury in the war, an impact injury from a bomb blowing up. They may have PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. You have people with schizophrenia who are not necessarily veterans, but just people who are out there. When I was doing work in the 80s, you know, from deinstitutionalization, we used to come across folks.
People who had left the mental institutions and were now on the streets.
That's correct. That's correct.
Is that a myth or is that really true?
Now, that's really true. But what's happened now over the years, since that's a while back, deinstitutionalization, is in the 80s, I would see quite a few of these people around. And the issue was that we didn't have enough support services, and the thought was that people would stay on their psychotropic medications and people, you know, came off their meds, but also they didn't have the support services and the housing. And
that's what the Community Mental Health Facilities Act of 1963, I think it was all about, the Kennedy program. It never happened, right? I mean, the system of freestanding mental health institutions never happened.
It never happened. And to this day, what we're trying to reconstruct really on the homeless level is housing with support services. I mean, that's the key. If we're going to help the folks that are out there, there's so many folks out there with disabilities, whether it's developmental issues, whether it's mental health issues, whether it's brain injury issues. This is among the long-term homeless. And I think this is what people forget. You know, they see someone homeless, they say they're choosing to be out there. But these are folks out there that really are struggling with their day-to-day function and survival.
Can you give us, put a face on some of these people for us? Give us an idea. You don't, of course, have to use the name, but who they are, because statistically we can relate to what you're saying. Mm-hmm. But when there's a face on it, somehow it becomes a lot clearer.
Well, one of the stories that I open up in the book is about Old Man Ray. That's what he would call himself. And he was living at the Port Authority in New York City. This was in the 1980s. And Ronald Reagan was coming out of office and homelessness was on the rise. And there was Old Man Ray sitting on a milk crate. And I was a new social worker full of ideals.
You know, who are you working for? Is this your internship at Columbia or?
This was right after. I was working for the Manhattan Bowery Corporation. And that's an interesting story in itself because they came out of the old work in the Bowery with the flop houses.
Sure.
And the detoxes. And you know, what changed over time with Reagan coming into office is there was a lot of affordable housing that was not being continued to be constructed like was being done during the Carter administration and prior.
Why is that?
Well, I don't know the answer as to why, to be honest with you. I know that was the policy of that administration.
See, I have this theory about the middle class. My theory, Jay Levy, is that the middle class vote, and if you do something socially for them, Medicare, that kind of thing, they care. But when it's for the poor don't vote. Therefore, they don't have any political clout. Therefore, a guy like Carter comes along who has a heart and a soul, and he says, let's do something, you know, to take care of this terrible, terrible problem. But the middle class come along and they say, nothing doing. We're going to look the other way. And hence the difference between the two groups. Based on your brilliance as a social worker, do you think that there is a grain of truth to what I suspect?
Well, I think so. I think that, you know, part of our job is to give voice to the people who are impoverished and don't have voice otherwise. And the homeless is certainly among that population, a silent population across the country that really is not represented, unfortunately. So, empowerment is about trying to get people involved and to give them a voice in the system somehow.
So let's go back to the story.
Okay. So there's Old Man Ray, and he's sitting on a milk crate, not very mobile. You know, he's in his late 60s. And a lot of people you meet who are homeless when they're that of that age, they look considerably older because they've been living outside and really struggling. And so I approach him, and I'm thinking, this is a guy who really needs help, and he's going to be pretty receptive, I would imagine, being in the dire straits that he was in. So I came over to him, and I'm still adapting to my world.
The dire straits he said he was in.
Well, the dire straits I thought he was in. That's the key. That I thought. That was my perception. Okay. So I go over to Old Man Ray, and I ask him how he's doing and try to offer some help. And he right away sets me straight. He lets me know that first of all, he's the night watchman of the Port Authority. And he knows all the going-ons. You know, he knows what's happening in the building. He's kind of like an information center. And if he can help me in any way, you know, I should let him know. So he immediately reversed the table, so to speak. And it was very interesting. It was a great lesson for me because, I really thought it would be easier than that to help and to get to know folks. So what happened over time, over necessity, is I took a different approach. Instead of coming over there kind of with my list of referrals and saying, this is where you can go to get help, I realized I had to get to know him and understand his world and his values. and kind of how he adapted to the situation. I mean, this is how he found meaning in his world. And, you know, the mind is incredible in this way. So, you know, it's also clinical work that we do. I call it outreach counseling is what we're doing, because, you know, he had to somehow get along in this world of not having a home, not having a place to sleep. And somehow it turned out that he was in charge of the entire Port Authority, at least in his world, in his way of seeing things. And this made him feel quite a bit better about his situation and gave him a sense of control. And I had to be careful that in the way that I offered to help, that I didn't take that away from him, because this was part of his survival strategy.
Now, this is spoken, Jay Levy, as a social worker. There are those of us, and I am sorry how this is going to come out, who use the Port Authority and who, you know, can sense an obvious sense of smell, you know, who are hit upon by, you know, people who are sitting around. We tend to think of them as vagrants. You're somebody I'd love to emulate in terms of social conscience. But the people who use the Port Authority aren't always nearly as understanding of them or their narratives as you are. And maybe you could talk about that a little bit.
Well, first of all, I think that's perfectly understandable, right? Those folks that are using the Port Authority have their own concerns, their day-to-day struggles of going to work and a certain quality of life. And I think, it, you know, if you think about what this is about, what we want to do is to help people to be able to move on from the Port Authority and places like that. We want to get people into housing, and we want to say that part of the issue with homelessness is it takes away from everybody's quality of life. So this is really a social issue, and it's important for communities to be involved. And frankly, this is happening more and more widely as we sit. There's a lot of planning going on, you know, 5-year plans, 10-year plans to address homelessness. And the big movement throughout the country, although, you know, it's underfunded, of course, is Housing First. And what Housing First is about is instead of waiting for people to agree to treatment programs to bring them in from the streets to people who are long-term, you get them into housing right off the bat, or at least you can make that offer very early on. Literally, it's people doing the outreach that have access to apartments, that have a key, so you're attaching the homeless resource directly to the outreach workers. And once that relationship is there, once there's some engagement, which happened with old man Ray over over a month or so, he got to know me before you knew it. You know, whenever I was walking through the Port Authority, he'd be calling me over to have a discussion and to tell me a little bit about, you know, the greatness of America and his World War II history. And, you know, he was very proud to be American and to be doing what he had done in his life, serving the country. And part of that pride is what was also getting in the way of him being able to accept help from me. But as I got to know him, and as I was able to ask him about, you know, one day I asked him, well, how's your feet? And that really opened the door to something. You know, he really began to say, well, actually, I'm having a tough time with my feet. So he wasn't ready to talk about the fact that he was taking a nip from time to time and maybe there was an addiction. Or he wasn't ready to talk about the fact that he was elderly and maybe needed some help and didn't have employment. But his feet, that was something in the here and now that he could relate to.
How did you know to ask the question?
Well, when you learn about the world of homeless folks, you realize very quick that their feet are very important to them. I mean, that's how they get around. And so I was learning and adapting to outreach. I was seeing some signs that his ankles looked a little swollen. And as you can imagine, people are staying in the same socks and the same shoes. And you often see this, you know, with the folks who are homeless. We'd see people with hernias, we'd see people with arthritis, we'd see people with issues with their feet. So this was something that resonated in his world, and we were able to set up some outreach for foot soaks and that kind of thing. And it led to him needing to go to an emergency room for care.
Now, say that because we're also interested in that. So it led to. So can you remember that breakthrough? Can you remember how it led to that?
Well, the breakthrough is sad in itself, because I went over to the Port Authority, and there he was. He had a cane which would help him to get around the area, and someone had stolen his cane. And he really couldn't move. He hadn't gotten off that milk crate for the past 24 hours.
The police never moved him along?
They had not moved him along. You know, he was dehydrated, You know, I immediately got him some fluids and some food, and we sat and we talked. And I convinced him. He didn't want to go over to VA. He had a lot of issues with the idea of getting, you know, free help. You know, it's the way he thought about it.
He was a World War II veteran, you said?
World War II veteran.
And so, therefore, was entitled to help by the VA.
Entitled to help, absolutely. But
does the VA do anything for the homeless?
They do quite a bit now, and it really depends on what state you're in, the level of, you know, funding and commitment of what goes on. But back then, when I brought him over to the emergency room, people were looking at me. One attendant pulled me to the side and said, you know, why are you bringing people like this in here? It was really quite surprising to me.
You may want to read Samuel Shemp's The House of God, which is about major hospital and what they call these people. Get out of my emergency room. And, you know, this is not what they wanted. So how did you as a social worker respond to the attendant who pulled you over?
Well, what happened was that was preparing me for the doctor that was going to see him next. And the attendant wasn't the one that was going to work with him. So I just kind of took that in and I said, okay, this is going to be a bit of advocacy and going to be a strain. I was very upset by what he had said. You remember, I was a young social worker, so this took
me. You'd be upset by it now, too.
Yeah. Well, I guess if I wasn't upset by it, it wouldn't be a good thing. But it did take me back. You know, I was surprised. Now I wouldn't be so surprised to hear that. So we started meeting with the emergency room doctor, and he was patching up the guy's feet and ready to send him back to the Port Authority. And I said to the doctor, you're really going to send this elderly person back to the Port Authority, you know, patched up like this? He still can't walk. You know, he needs some more help. They expected me to be changing the bandages out over there, which didn't seem like the most sanitary conditions to be doing that. And we were able to, as I was saying that, actually, old man Ray suddenly yelled out, I don't want to go back to the Port Authority. And it was the first time he gave voice to that. And the doctor heard that and was a bit, I think, shaken, taken back. And he said, well, let me see what I can do. And he, you know, made some calls to see if he can get a bed. And that's how he ended up in the hospital. And from there, I visited him, worked with the social work department, and they got him into a VA home. So, and he was able to stay there. And
the key here was that he had to articulate that he didn't want to be there.
He had to articulate it, and I think that's the challenge of how do you help people, how do you bridge people to the point of being able to articulate that. And I think him having the support and me being there and him seeing the advocacy going on and seeing that someone cared and him being in a dire situation, it all kind of came together.
The book is Homeless Narratives and Pre-Treatment Pathways from Words to Housing, and it's by J.S. Levy, MSW, LICSW, licensed social worker. Jay, let me then go to ask you, we heard the story of Old Man Ray. What other stories can you see here? Because I think when people hear these narratives, it's very different than some dry statistical, you know, analysis of what's going on.
Yes, I agree. Well, out in a shelter in Boston, and I worked in New York City, I worked in Boston, I worked in the woods of Western Massachusetts, so the stories really vary depending on the settings. I met a gentleman by the name of Andrew, who was homeless for over 18 years, an African-American gentleman in his 40s, And, you know, it's incredible when you think about it. Someone was living for primarily outside, sometimes in the shelter, for 18 years. And when I met with him, first of all, it took several months before he would even talk to me, even give me the time of day. And I just kept approaching.
Well, how'd you first come up upon him?
I was doing outreach at a shelter in the Boston area, and I would have regular nights that I would visit at the shelter.
Now, were you working for an agency at the time, or what were you doing there?
Yeah, I was working for Tri-City Mental Health Services, and I was part of the PATH program, which is providers that provide transition to folks who are homeless to other services. That's the PATH program. And so it's all clinicians that go out and do the outreach. And I had met Andrew over there. I knew his name from the shelter list. And again, he was someone that initially did not want to talk much. But one day I had approached him.
Well, where was it? Give us a picture.
Well, this was in a shelter in the Dorchester area of Boston. It was an overflow shelter. So this was hard for people to actually get into the shelter. They'd have to, you know, be bussed over there. And most of the people that went there were barred from all of the other shelters in the region.
Why?
And it was a church. Well, people get barred for different behavioral issues. Sometimes it has to do with if someone has a mental health issue and they're going in and out of crisis, depending how the staff sees it, they might see it as a mental health crisis or they might see it as someone purposely giving them a hard time. Both things happen in the shelters. It's hard to decipher which is what. So what would happen is people would get barred. Sometimes people were drinking, so that would be an issue, and people would get barred for that. Again, if it got, it depends on the behaviors, how threatening the behaviors would be. They're looking for a certain amount of civility. The people in charge of the shelters are concerned about, you know, the safety of the environment. So they're kind of running it often like wardens on some level. And so this guy is someone who would normally stay outside. He really wasn't comfortable around other folks. So when I met him at the shelter, one day we were able to have a conversation. And I talk about in the book going through stages of engagement. So the first goal is just to get an initial conversation going, initial communication that somehow is welcome. The next goal is to get an ongoing conversation where you can meet more than once, where that's welcomed, and you're defining your roles, you're introducing who you are, the services that you connect to, how you can help, you're setting up boundaries for the relationship.
Now, do they teach all of this in social work school?
They do, but they teach you in social work school more from the standpoint of treatment. And so when I wrote the book, you know, I really wanted to get into these basic pre-treatment principles. When they go over engagement and relationship building and contracting, you get the sense of it being a very quick process.
But so what's contracting?
Contracting is when you're setting goals with the individual. It's an agreement between you and the individuals on what kind of work you're going to do together.
So how did that happen in this case? So you walked into the shelter, there he was. That's contact, right?
That's contact. And at first he's telling me, you know, to scram, to get away. He doesn't want to work with me. So over time I say, well, maybe I'll work with some people in his vicinity. Maybe over time he'll see that I'm an okay guy because I'm working with the guy next to him and we're getting somewhere. And so he got to see me. He adapted to my presence over a long period of time. And eventually, we had kind of that first meeting where there was some conversation going on. It was a little strained, but it was there. And what he said to me kind of opened up. He said, look, you don't understand. I've been mentally murdered. That was his framing of kind of where he was at.
So was he paranoid or had he been mentally murdered?
Well, in his world, it made sense to him. There was some paranoia there, but in his world, he looked at it like he had been oppressed by white society. It didn't help that I was a white social worker, you know, trying to connect with him. He looked at it like his career. He had worked for the T at one point, meaning for the transit authority. And he had lost that job. He was working his store. As the story unfolded, he told me about how he worked at the transit authority. And when he would go to the shelter, because he was working late hours at night, eventually they told him he had to come in earlier to the shelter, which didn't mesh well with his hours at the transit authority. And so he felt like he had to either leave his job or not stay at the shelter.
Why couldn't he afford housing if he had a gainful employment?
What happened at the time was before he ended up homeless, there was a fire at the place where he lived. And so he had to leave that place. And then he tried to go to a YMCA, and he was staying at the YMCA. And what occurred there was you could stay for a couple weeks at a time, but then they would tell you you'd have to leave, and then you could come back over a certain period of time. So it was hard for him to find new affordable housing. Plus, he had some mental health concerns, so he wasn't functioning on a level that maybe you and I could function and easily find housing and make it. So he ends up in a shelter. So then when he's working at the shelter, all of a sudden they're telling him the hours that he's working is not working well with the schedule at the shelter. He needs to be in earlier. So then he starts staying at all-night movie theaters and trying to go into work and to make it that way. And that didn't work out for him. And so he became very, very angry and had an incident where he acted out at one of the shelters, and he ended up in the hospital and he lost his job. And this was the beginning of how he pictured the mental murder that occurred to him, that his world was somehow taken away from him.
But a murder always has a murderer. Who's the murderer in this case? Society?
Well, he saw it as society. He saw it as white society. He saw it as
racist society.
Yes, as being oppressed. And this was a guy who was paranoid on a level that he would talk about how he'd go in for interviews then to find other jobs, and that the person talking with him would be holding a pen and pointing the pen toward him. And he felt threatened by that. So there was some real psychosis here. And so I was getting to know him. Now, I can't just approach someone like that and offer them mental health services. You know, when someone's paranoid, I mean, that's the whole issue. They don't know that they're paranoid. They think this is what's really going on. So the trick is how to connect with him and to understand his world. And part of it is he was saying, look, I don't play the game anymore. So I had to figure out a few different things. I had to figure out, what does that mean he doesn't play the game anymore? What does that mean?
It means that he's had a lot of white social workers in his life, and he knew how to play the client.
Well, and it meant to him also, it gave him power, because it meant to him that he was now an observer, that he was no longer participating in the system. He was kind of on the edge of the shelter, watching everybody else do their thing. He would say, you know, one day I saw a dollar on the street. Do you think I went down and picked up that dollar? He'd say, no, that's what they want me to do. I'm not going to pick up that dollar. I'm not playing that game. So he felt very much like he was being set up from time to time. So with him, you know, the breakthrough was really getting to know him and looking at whether or not he qualified for Social Security benefits, which he certainly did. He couldn't work. He was very paranoid. He wasn't going to be able interpersonally to make it through an interview, let alone to get along with coworkers and to
and of
do
course,
he
had been putting into Social Security.
Well, he had for years when he had worked, and so the trick was to work with this guy and let him know that he actually deserved Social Security. But he couldn't hear it from the level of paranoia. So this is where we get into the kind of the houses of language that I talk about in the book. I had to bridge from his language, and his language was really about trauma, that people had put me through all this. And I said to him, you know, you strike me as someone who's been like through a war, through a battle, homeless 18 years, traumatized from all the times that you've tried to get work, and you're telling me that you can't, that you feel threatened by people, you know, pointing pens at you and so forth. He went even as far as to say that he can't even take a bus anymore or take a subway because it reminds him, it triggers too much stuff. You know, it reminds him of the job he used to have and what had been taken away. And I said to him, it seems to me you've paid your taxes in the past. You had a job. You feel like you've been wronged. You've been homeless for 18 years. Anybody in your situation would need some help. And this is a way to get it, to get Social Security benefits. So I talked the language of trauma, and that resonated in his world. And he would say, and this was in his language, the only thing that survived the war for me is my soul. That's what survived. He goes, everything else was taken away. So he felt a certain amount of trust in me at that point. But he would say to me, you know, when you try to get me benefits, what's going to happen when somebody tries to take care of you because you're trying to help me? And I said, Andrew, you know, we'll cross that bridge when it happens. Let's give this a try.
Did you get the feeling he was working you, manipulating you, that he had been there before?
No, not at all. In fact, he didn't even want benefits. So that's the thing. I mean, I had to, over time, convince him to give it a try. So there was no sense at all of him working me or manipulating me. This was a person, I just want to be very clear, this was a person with major mental illness, homeless for 18 years. And these are the folks that other people maybe see walking the streets and say, you know what? They're choosing to be out there.
What was the contract part of this? You said the various stages. At some point, you get to the contract. What contract did you make with him?
Well, the contract was to, well, first of all, the contract was that he would continue to meet with me and that he found our meetings to be helpful. Because once he was able to actually tell his story, and this was further down the road, right? First, we had to just get an initial communication going. But once he began to tell his story and he actually realized I was listening to him, that was really something for this guy, because he felt like, first of all, he no longer played the game, and nobody wants to listen to him. So to have someone there who was an active listener was incredible to him. But secondly, the contract became to work on getting Social Security benefits. And what I'm leaving out is a very important part of this, and that is that the other thing he would tell me is, I'm doing my research. This is what he would say all the time. So one day I said to him, well, what's your research? And this was the little gem in everything going on, because this wasn't the problem-laden area. This was one of his strengths. And the research wasn't necessarily anything that was real, but in his world, it was about time travel. So he was talking about Einstein and reading up on books and thinking about time travel. And I went with that. Instead of saying, well, that doesn't make sense, or, you know, how are you doing research and time travel living in the shelter and questioning any of that, I went with that as a worthy goal that he had because it was important to him. It was part of his meaning in the world of this sheltering. And what I did is I bridged that idea of time travel and the work that he was doing to saying, well, wouldn't it be good to get an apartment where you can be, where you can do more of this research, where you can have a quiet place and really think and not be around the shelter and all the stimulation. And that made a difference for him. He agreed that would be great, but he said, how are we ever going to do that? And that's how the issue of benefits came up. And even then he said, he laughed. He said, there's no way I'll qualify for a benefit. You know, he goes, what do you think, I'm crazy? And I said, no, I don't think you're crazy. I think you're someone who's been through a lot of trauma and deserves more.
Did he ever think he was crazy? Did you think?
No. No, he never thought he was crazy. But the funny thing is, and the great thing about it, is eventually he was able to also apply for Department of Mental Health services. So not only did I get him on a benefit, but we used the same strategies and the same languaging, him being mentally murdered, him not playing the game, him being homeless for 18 years, all the things that he thought happened to him, people taking away his career. He was happy to write all that on the form that we would hand in to the Department of Mental Health to try to get him support services. But what I had to do, and this is the bridging, what I call it is bridging language, I had to bridge his idea of trauma and all the things that happened to him and the help that he needed to the Department of Mental Health, as well as give a diagnosis, which now I'm talking a clinical language, where I had to write down paranoid schizophrenia. And I even had to get to the point of trying to explain to him there's some diagnoses that he may not agree with, but sort of captures the languaging that he's using.
And when he found out, Jay Levy, when he found out that you had used those diagnostic words, was he upset with him?
No, because I prepared him over time to understand what I was doing. And we talked about, like, we talked about when we went to Social Security in that house of language, they're going to talk about the world of disability, because that's what Social Security, SSDI, is about. You know, it's disability insurance, and it's about the fact that you can't work. And it took him, he wouldn't admit that right off the bat, but after I got to know him and understood his story and could frame it all out and say, you know, the way you talk about mental murder and trauma, that's what they call disability in that house of language.
Interesting. But to some degree, for a guy who said, I'm not going to play the game, he was back in the game and he knew he was back in the game. I mean, when he filled out those forms with you, that was the game.
He was back in the game, but now the game
looked like mine had a win.
Well, yeah. Not just a win. It had a whole new sort of reconstruction, a whole new meaning, I think, for him. His view, his perception of the game was different, and that's the key. And so that's sort of the narrative piece. You know, things changed. His story changed. He had 18 years on the sidelines. And 18 years of why play the game if all I'm going to get for it
is... not going to get anything.
Right. Not only that, I'm going to be traumatized by it.
And where did he end up?
Well, he ended up housed with a support service through the Department of Mental Health. He got subsidized...
Where was he?
...housing. He was housed in the Boston area. And for a while, you know, I continued to visit with him. And you know, part of the book also talks about supporting transitions and the adaptation process to new housing. He was a pretty high-functioning guy in many ways, very paranoid, but very high-functioning. And he was connected to a mental health clinic, did not begin a medication regimen, as far as I knew, when I left the work, but was now connected to people at a mental health clinic, was now connected to a case manager, had subsidized housing, and was no longer wandering, you know, the streets day in and day out. So I thought it was quite a successful story.
You know, one of the things that struck me, Jay Levy, at the beginning of this interview was you gave a definition of what you had to be in order to be counted by the HUD, the Housing and Urban Development people. But there are a lot of other people who are homeless. There are moms who have been abused by their spouses, or who just single moms who just can't pay the rent. And they go and live in a car somewhere, or they live in a cardboard box. And do we count those people?
We do. I was giving you a definition of chronically homeless. Mm-hmm. And that's about the chronic homeless population is about 20% of the homeless population, particularly of homeless individuals, that is. So the people that are living in cars or family homelessness, that's another percentage. So if you have 640,000 people who are homeless on a particular day count of the homeless, about 60% of the homeless or more, a little more, are individuals. About 40% are families. And then that breaks down further into people who are sheltered, people who are unsheltered, which might include people living in cars. What the HUD definition does not include is all the people that are doubled up. You know, they don't have homes of their own, but they might be doubled up with family or friends, or what we call couch surfing, going from place to place to place. The HUD definition doesn't capture that. Again, a lot of homeless advocates would say, you know, that should be looked at and counted. So the reason I focused, again, on long-term homelessness, first of all, it's what I've done for many years, and just have found interesting people's stories and the individuals that are out there and struggling. But also, these are the folks that a lot of the money gets spent on. So when I talk about housing first, and the reason that's become popular across the country now, as places like D.C. and Vermont and New York City and Massachusetts, where I work, we're doing housing first programs. The reason that's become popular, because it's really looked at as a cost savings way of helping people.
How so?
Well, to house someone with a support service may cost, and a subsidy, anywhere from $15,000 to $20,000 a year. That's the cost of it. But if we don't house these people, again, what I'm talking about is the long-term homeless, the most vulnerable among us. What happens is these folks end up going in and out of emergency rooms. They end up having hospital stays. There was an interesting article by Malcolm Gladwell that ran in The New Yorker, and he talked about Million Dollar Murray. And this was a guy who was homeless for over 10 years, living in Reno, Nevada, and his hospital bills came up to over $1 million. And he was a heavy time, you know, big time drinker. He would get maybe a couple months sobriety here, a couple months sobriety there, and would do very well when sober. I mean, he could work, he could do all of that. But when he was drinking, he would be just staying on the streets. He'd fall down, he'd have medical issues, and this would run a lot of money. And there was more than one Murray. You know, there was all these other people in Reno, Nevada, that were in similar circumstances, running up very large medical bills. And so there's been, through Housing First, there's been studies done that has shown that for about $20,000 or a little less, you can house someone and you can kind of build the services around them and you can reduce their medical bills. So there's been...
They won't go to the emergency room?
Not as much, not nearly as often, and they won't end up inpatient nearly as often. And there's another good reason for doing this. I mean, first of all, so there's the physical issue, right? It's costing us money. There's the quality of life issues. You see these folks on the streets, and you're saying, you know, when I go to the park, how come the park is full of people who are homeless? You know, you want a better quality of life. Or the people that are running businesses see people who are homeless at their doorsteps, and it gets in the way of the patrons. So those are all good reasons for doing it. But there's an ethical reason for doing it. We have people that are living outside, and they're dying. There's been an interesting study done by Dr. James O'Connell. He wrote a recommendation for my book, Works for Boston Healthcare for the Homeless. Him and Dr. Wang did a vulnerability study and found that people in certain high-risk groups were at high risk of dying. 40% of the population that he studied died over a five-year period. People who were living outside for 6 months or more and fell into various high-risk categories, including what we call trimorbidity, meaning people with major mental illness, addiction, and a chronic medical condition. Those were folks who were in a high-risk group, and many of them were dying living outside. People who had been to an emergency room and inpatient three or more times over the past year and living outside, they were part of this high-risk group and could die. Folks who had HIV or AIDS, they were part of this high-risk group. People over 60 years old, the elderly, were part of this high-risk group. And the list goes on and on. But it's an interesting list and an interesting study, which really showed that, and people, I think, tend to not really think about this. And you don't really hear much press about it. But that every year, there's people literally, you know, dying outside that are homeless.
I can't be outside for 25 minutes in this cold. It's amazing to just think about people living out there, whether it's on the stoops of a church on Amsterdam Avenue in New York City or somewhere else. It's got to be very rough. Which brings me into my next question. You're a social worker. How can you do it? I mean, a lot of people are listening to this, Jay Levy, and they're saying, how can this guy go out there and work with these folks and not feel, you know, emotionally battered after a while?
Well, I like connecting to people, and I like hearing their stories, and I like the challenge. And I think it's something, you know, obviously, I suppose through my own family life and just the friends that I've had and the people that I've seen struggle with mental illness, I get quite a bit of gratification connecting with someone who I know is in need and finding a way to help them.
Now, I'm sorry for interrupting, Jay, but I know a lot of social workers in my life, and some of them get very tough after a while. They get so tough because they just really can't face it. So, you know, they're going to build a wall around themselves, which is, you know, protective.
Right.
How come you haven't done that? Or have you?
Well, I haven't. And partly is it's a lot of it is the self-care that's involved in the work. So you have to be able to, I mean, you can't just go 24/7 and be doing this all the time. You do get that tough exterior. We call it, you know, burnout, where you're not there no longer as a helper. You know, you're there as, you know, you start taking this approach maybe, which is like the tough love approach toward helping everyone. And if it was that simple, if we could go out to help the homeless and take a tough love approach and just wait for people to bottom out, which would be, you know, the whole AA lingo and the way to go about it, what happens is what we found as we studied this long-term homeless population is they don't bottom out. They die. They end up in jail. They get hurt very seriously, but they don't bottom out. So, of course, there are segments of the homeless population that do, but I'm talking about this long-term that have really adapted to the homelessness. So for me, I've just always been very careful, and that careful and caring, and that's for myself as well, not just for the people I help. So I really think about my mental health and what I have to do to maintain it. So I take breaks, you know, I go on holiday. I've done different types of work from direct care to management. Currently, I supervise 15 mental health clinicians that go out and do this work on the streets.
Who do you do that for an agency?
Elliott Homeless Services, Elliott CHS Homeless Services. And I am the Western and Central Mass regional manager. And we have people that are stationed either doing street outreach or stationed in shelters across half of Massachusetts that I supervise. And now I get to live vicariously through their stories. I get to hear their stories of how they've tried to help people.
Do they burn out?
They can. I mean, that's the risk to the work. So, you know, comes again to understanding that there's a self-care aspect to this. This isn't all about you just go out and save people at any cost. This is about finding a balance. And in fact, if you get too much into that notion that I'm out to save people, not only does your own self-care go downhill, but the work you do probably is not very good. You probably try to go too quickly. You probably don't respect people's worlds and boundaries. You may take people into your own home or something along those lines, which wouldn't be a good idea in terms of boundary issues with the people we're trying to help. So we have to find a way to care for ourselves. And that means also having good clinical supervision, having group support. And so I'm involved in all of that. In the book, I have a chapter that talks about supervision, talks about ways to support the workers, that really we need to be healthy and out there and energized and well-boundaried and thinking clinically on how to help folks.
Have you ever feared for your life, feared for your loved ones as a social worker, fearing that somebody who's paranoid, you know, might at some point flip and see you as somebody who, you know, was trying to harm them?
Yeah, you know, I've done this work for over 20 years, and I must say there's been very few times where I've felt real fearful. I mean, although in the beginning of the work, and I talk about stages of engagement and the way that we go about it, the first stage, the pre-engagement stage, where you're just trying to get that initial communication going on, you're assessing for safety. So part of your approach is you're thinking about, is this a safe situation? Is the person looks out of control? You know, what you're thinking about things like personal space. How close can I get to the person? We always look at it like the person we're approaching, we're kind of entering their world. So we enter it cautiously. It's like entering someone's home. You don't just go in there, barge in there, and we're not trying to force anything on anybody. And so that gives us kind of a layer of protection. People pick up on that very quick, that we're respecting their autonomy. So we're trying to build trust. We're trying to respect autonomy. We're thinking in terms of safety issues. This is all involved in the very first approach to the person that we try to help.
Now, Jay Levy, we only have a few minutes left, so I wanted to ask you this. Why'd you write this book, and who's it for?
Well, I wrote the book to tell the stories of people that are out there and struggling and to realize that there's some lessons that can be learned when we hear those stories on how to help. And I give an approach toward helping, what I call a pre-treatment approach, based on these basic principles of pre-treatment that we talked about today, relationship building, safety issues, supporting transition, facilitating the change process.
So who should be reading this? Other social workers who are coming along?
Other social workers, outreach workers. I think anyone that's really interested in the stories of the homeless and the lessons that can be learned from it, I think might find it to be a valuable book.
I mean, I can understand why social workers should read the book. I have no question about it. But why should the lay reader who is looking for a book read Homeless Narratives and Pre-Treatment Pathways from Words to Housing?
Well, I think I'm not saying all lay readers should, but I think people who are real interested in the human condition and what it is that people go through, stories of survival and meaning making. And I think you'll find that this goes on regardless of whether you're homeless or doing whatever else you're doing in the world. And I think the strategies of engagement and helping also, it's not just for working with the homeless, it's working for hard to reach populations across the board.
Jay Levy, are people good or bad?
Well, I guess I believe people are good, right? That's why I'm out doing what I do.
Wow. And here I've always thought that it's a mixture and some people are very bad, some people are very good. I'm always fascinated by what leads people into professions like yours. And with some people it's a job, with some people it's a passion. And clearly in your case it's a bit of a passion.
For me it's definitely a passion, and I believe in reaching toward the good that you can find in people. I do also agree with you, it is a mix, but I think, you know, when you do this work and you work with someone, you reach toward the positive and you go from there.
Are you optimistic that we'll ever share enough so that everybody will have a home?
I like the ideal. We strive toward the ideal. I'm not optimistic that everyone will have a home, but I believe that it's important to have those ideals and to strive toward them.
Every once in a while, I meet a special education teacher and I'll say, you know, God bless you. This is terrific that you're doing this work, because it's work I couldn't do. I could not do it personally. It would make me too depressed. And you talked about that a little bit in terms of how you control for your own mental health and doing it. So on behalf of everybody else, I want to thank you, Jay, for writing this book, Homeless Narratives and Pre-Treatment Pathways from Words to Housing, J.S. Levy, MSW. And, you know, it looks to me like the Bible for people who want to do this kind of work.
Well, thanks for having me. It's been great being here, wherever here may be.
Been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.